Creating Tools for Developers with Amanda Silver. Welcome to the Azure for Executives podcast, the show for technology leaders. This podcast covers trends in technologies and industries and how Microsoft Azure is enabling them. Here you'll hear from thought leaders in various industries and technologies on topics important to you. People who create tools for developers are some of the better known rock stars in our industry. And today we're joined by Amanda Silver, Corporate Vice President of Product in Microsoft's Developer Division, or what we'll call DevDiv today. And definitely a rock star in this space. Been there for quite a while, and now she oversees Microsoft's developer tools, runtimes, and services. Now I'm going to quickly run through what some of those are, but be prepared for a fairly exhaustive list. So this includes Visual Studio, Visual Studio Code, .NET and C Sharp, TypeScript, the OpenJDK, Developer Experience for Azure, our Azure Application Development PaaS and Serverless offerings, Azure DevOps, the Open Source Programs Office, and Microsoft's First Party Engineering Systems team. Wow, that is a lot, Amanda.
a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'll bet it is. Yeah, that's great. Please tell us just a little bit more about yourself, maybe, and what gets you up in the morning.
Yeah, well, actually, it's now been almost 22 years at Microsoft, always working on behalf of developers. And, you know, I came to Microsoft as a college hire, straight out of college. My older brothers were both in the tech industry. And, you know, at that in that era, 2001 timeframe, that was kind of the end of the first dot-com bubble bust. And so they were each on their second or third startup by that time. And so I was looking for something stable to support my lifestyle through graduate school as like a little bit of a pad. And so I ended up interviewing at Microsoft, and I interviewed with somebody who really saw something in me. The person is Chris Dias. He's now the GPM for Visual Studio Code. And he saw that I was really passionate about being an undergraduate TA. And I supported a lot of people who wanted to study computer science to be successful in their chosen major. And what he told me was that the best way for me to continue that passion was to come to Microsoft and work in the developer division. And, you know, 22 years later, that's what gets me up in the morning. I'm really excited every single day, honestly, genuinely, to work on behalf of developers and to make them more capable of kind of, you know, just being creative.
That's very, very cool. Thanks for that. And, you know, to sort of kick this off, I'll say that with regard to helping developers in recent years, Microsoft sort of branched out and is now building across many, many tech stacks. So how does DevDiv's work impact the software development community at large, maybe even outside of the Microsoft-only ecosystem?
Oh, that is such a broad and good question. You know, I think, first of all, we do think about things very much from the perspective of the individual developer and their associated engineering team and everything that they need to be successful in terms of taking an idea and translating that into code and then ultimately deploying that into production. But we also are really, really aware of kind of the broader ecosystem that developers participate in, right? And so, you know, if you think about the evolution of the way that applications and software have been built over the last, you know, decade, one of the things that has really changed is the fact that basically everybody is using open source components today. Whereas 10 years ago, that might have been a little bit more unusual. And so the result of that is that, in a sense, I see the broad developer ecosystem as being very much more connected than it was a decade ago, where, you know, anyone who's building an application today, 90% of them, of new projects, start with an open source component. And by the time it ships to production, 99% of them include an open source component. And so that means that you're basically collaborating with the broader ecosystem in the development world. And so in terms of Microsoft's impact, we both can think about how we can make individual developers more productive and their teams within their organizations in the context of their private repo. But we also really think about it in that larger ecosystem. And so, you know, whether that's contributing back to open source projects like the JDK, or, you know, various different standards, or, you know, making sure that the overall supply chain for open source is more secure and that more trustworthy, you know, we contribute to all of those things. Or that, you know, if you want to use a package from NPM or from NuGet, that's also something that you can have confidence in and that you can reach the people who are building those components, because in a sense, they're a part of your team now, too.
Thank you, Amanda, and welcome to the show. So excited to have you here. And as someone who's really sort of grown up as a developer myself, I'll say it's great to hear you calling out, you know, kind of developer in terms of your role. And I'm sure we have that quote somewhere in our past. So I thought I'd throw it out there. With that said, you know, let's talk about GitHub Copilot, and it's a recent AI-driven innovation in software development. Could you tell us a little bit about what Copilot is and how does it work?
I think for many years, more than a decade, the folks who have been working on tools for developers have seen the potential of the opportunity to take AI and to actually enlighten the developer environment of the individual developer or their broad team to augment the developer so that they actually can, you know, the thing that I always think about is how can I make sure that developers focus on the code that only they can write, the code that's really unique to them and to their organization, so that they don't need to write as much boilerplate code, so that they don't need to change their code so much to conform to coding standards inside of their organization, but really that they get to focus on the unique IP that they're bringing into their solution. And so, you know, that's really how we think about the application of AI into code. You know, how can we eliminate the repetitive and the tedious and the mundane? And also, how can we, you know, especially in the case of generative AI, how can we actually use it to spark creativity and to spark, you know, how you think about what the potential solution might be? And so, you know, there's many different applications of AI for code. You know, some of them we have in the latest versions of the Visual Studio and Visual Studio Code. For example, repeated edits. You know, you might make an edit one time in a certain spot in code, and we can use AI models to actually detect other spots in code where you might want to make a similar edit or even the same edit but apply it to multiple places. But then there's kind of the generative AI category. And so this is kind of the idea, you know, when I started in the industry, the big thing was IntelliSense, right? You write a line of code, and when you hit dot, there was a completion list. And that was magic when I graduated college. I went from, you know, Emacs in that era, which didn't have IntelliSense at the time, to, you know, Visual Studio, which had a pretty amazing experience for statement completion. But now with the predictive AI, we can actually get to the point where we can complete the entire line of code or even multiple lines of code for you, and potentially even beyond that, even multiple files in the future. So, you know, we're really entering this period where AI is going to dramatically reduce the number of keystrokes that you have to make to get the idea from your brain into the computer.
Thank you, Amanda. And before I pass over to David, you touched upon one of the, you know, kind of really the big innovations for me, which was IntelliSense. Mm-hmm. As someone who started out developing in VB3 and then Visual Basic 4, you know, it was glorious to see with Visual Studio and Visual Basic 5, the addition of IntelliSense, and obviously fast forward to today, and as you've said, it's really sort of groundbreaking, reduces keystrokes, you know, and really sort of is a key enabler to development. So just plus one to what you're saying, Amanda, and I'm such a fan of IntelliSense. David, over to you anyhow.
Okay, great. I would also like to delve into cloud a little bit. So anyone who uses Microsoft development tools knows that they integrate really well into the Azure cloud, you know, Visual Studio Code and Visual Studio in particular. So I'm wondering how creating developer tools today in that world of cloud might be different than it was before the rise of cloud computing.
Well, I mean, in a sense, the last vertical to be disrupted by the cloud is the developer stack. And part of the reason for that is that the developer stack has stayed largely on premises until really over the last couple of years. And so, you know, in a sense, if you think about it, we've moved to having like e-commerce all be hosted in the cloud, as an example. You wouldn't do it any other way. It's the default, you know, and then we've moved to hosting other applications in the cloud. But yet still, the development process, for the most part, for most people, still happens on your local desktop. You know, if you do your application build, oftentimes that happens on your local desktop, or it happens in an on-premises server in your organization. And, you know, even only fairly recently have people been moving to hosted source code repositories and, you know, having CI be powered in the public cloud, continuous integration. And so, you know, I think when we think about kind of what does the cloud mean for developer tools, it's really like every opportunity that the cloud brings to every vertical. First of all, you can get potentially infinite scale. You can get instant connectivity from anywhere in the world, and you get complete, you know, much larger data that you can pull from, and therefore intelligent models. And so that's how, you know, I think about how it's going to change the development process, you know, with cloud hosted IDEs and kind of cloud hosted workstations, like with Microsoft DevBox. The idea is you can actually get started in a new repo super, super quickly, even within a few seconds of joining the team once all of the perms have permeated. You know, you could actually get a dev box that is ready to contribute to that repo very, very quickly. And you can also have like burst scale. So for example, if you're doing something that's very intensive, then you might want to have a higher powered set of CPUs or even a GPU to do the task that you're trying to complete. And so now, by virtualizing the developer's desktop, we can actually deliver those kinds of things. We can also amortize the costs of things. For example, we can parallelize builds, or we can, you know, prime the dev box setup so that everybody on the team gets to benefit from some engineering systems work that maybe a few folks did, but they really kind of supercharged the entire team. The other thing that I think about is really how the fact that applications, the structure of applications is really changing. A decade ago, we were mostly thinking about client-server applications. Nowadays, we're mostly thinking about distributed applications, because if you're writing a cloud-native application, it's not just the client and the kind of, you know, front end of the server, but you also have you know, dependencies in terms of managed databases, or you know, application performance monitoring that you have to also instantiate and incorporate into your dev test prod stamps. And so now what we need to think about is how can we make developers much more successful in cloud distributed, public cloud hosted application runtimes.
One of the things you mentioned in there was DevBox, which I think would be of particular interest to many of our listeners. And so I wonder if you could tell us just a little bit about DevBox.
Yeah. So the idea is basically, how can we go from the local developer environment to have cloud hosted developer environments? And, you know, the benefits with that is you can, first of all, amortize the DevBox setup across the engineering team much more easily and quickly. You can access it from anywhere in the world. You can, you know, hibernate it and rehydrate it very quickly, so that you can actually, let's say, have multiple developer environments that you maintain based on the fact that you contribute to different projects. The cloud hosted version of a developer box, it's really optimized for the repo that you're working on, but it assumes that you're working in a Linux workstation that is, and you're building a cloud hosted application. But, you know, many of us are building Windows applications, or we have a dependency on something that you know, requires client-side execution, like performance analysis tools or database access tools. Or, you know, let's say I'm a AAA game developer. I actually need to have the runtime of the game kind of executing locally on my machine, given my high-powered game logic. And so for all of those kinds of environments, we have DevBox, Microsoft DevBox, which is really, in a sense, more of a workstation. If you think about GitHub Codespaces as a cloud-hosted workspace, Microsoft DevBox is more of a cloud-hosted workstation. And so it's actually built on top of Cloud PC, Windows 365. So it's Intune enrolled, and you get all of the great security benefits that you would have from any kind of cloud PC. But it's also optimized for, you know, dev interactivity and patterns. And so, you know, both that means in terms of the cost, it's optimized for interactive use. Over time, we're going to continue to optimize it for leveraging the power of the clouds for things like, you know, parallelizable builds or, you know, amortizing DevBox setup or making sure that the images are maintained as the repo evolves. One of the things that we're seeing, especially during the pandemic, as we saw a lot of development teams move from a hybrid friendly, kind of remote friendly workplace to a remote first workplace, is this is starting to become more of the default for many organizations. So we have a lot of folks really, really interested in leveraging Microsoft DevBox.
I love the kind of the landing here, the power and flexibility of virtualized environments. You know, and we will certainly share links in the show notes as well. So Amanda, we'd like to keep it real for our listeners. And so with that said, it would be great to share a little bit about some practical examples of how perhaps, you know, Microsoft and yourself and your teams are working with partners and customers. So as we think about things that are point of mind for you, as we think about industry trends, as we think about opportunity and helping our listeners, do you have maybe one or two customer stories point of mind you'd like to share with our audience?
Yeah, let me first start with partners. And obviously, this then kind of relates to customers. You know, I think one of the things that's really changed for Microsoft and the developer stack over the last decade is it used to be that we were really primarily a .NET and maybe a little bit of a C++ shop. Right? We built tools for those developers. But as you think about kind of the evolution of Azure, the public cloud, we really need to make sure that we're building an inclusive tent that everyone who's a developer feels like they can bring their solution to Azure and be successful with it. And so just thinking about a couple of partners that we've been working with, you know, one good example is VMware, where we've been partnering with them to host Spring applications with Azure Spring Apps, so that you can actually have your Spring solutions and bring them into the context of Azure. And this is something that we've been doing completely jointly with VMware. So developers get kind of the extra support from VMware, but they also get the benefits of cloud hosting and even the scale to zero kinds of capabilities that Azure gives to them. And, you know, we've done this in a way that we can make sure that we're keeping the runtime up to date and current so that it eliminates some of the management headaches that you might have in terms of the ops portions of maintaining application servers. Another good example, if you think about, you know, cloud native applications, as I mentioned, having application performance monitoring, you know, we've partnered with Datadog and New Relic and even, you know, Confluent and Nginx to support them bringing all of their solutions as first class solutions in the context of Azure. And so what that means is developers have an easier time instantiating those services in the context of the applications that they're building, especially when they're thinking about migrating their solutions from their on-premises hosts to their cloud hosts. This makes it a lot easier. And then just as an example, in terms of, you know, one example of a customer who's benefiting from it, you know, FedEx has been really working on optimizing their last mile delivery experience so that, you know, really they can deliver greater confidence and organizational efficiency to their team in terms of what is happening with packages on the ground? What's the estimated arrival time? And they've actually done a lot of innovative work in terms of thinking about how AI can actually help to give better prediction times for when packages are going to arrive or where the location is or where they should reroute things so that they have a better customer experience and ultimately service. And they've built all of that on top of Azure Spring Apps, which I mentioned we had been working on in conjunction with VMware.
So I love hearing about customer stories too. And shifting gears a bit, there's a lot of discussion out there on LinkedIn and other, you know, developer-focused conversations about platform engineering, maybe even as sort of the next level of DevOps, the maturation of DevOps. And so I'm wondering if this is something that DevDev, you in particular, are following.
Yeah, I mean, so I follow it from two perspectives. First, as the kind of product leader for developer division and all of the products that we work on and kind of trying to anticipate what trends are coming down the road. But then I also think about it as the leader of the first party engineering systems inside of Microsoft. Essentially, how do we customize the developer environments and engineering systems that we work on internally to support Microsoft's internal engineers? And so, you know, let's take the second one first and just talk about kind of some of the stuff that we're doing inside of Microsoft. Part of what we've been really focused on is making sure that we have much more standard environments in terms of our deployment so that we can have kind of consistency across all of these different deployment environments and engineering systems. So that, let's say there's a security breach and there's a package that has a security vulnerability in it, that we don't need to go and fix it in thousands of places. As an example, you can think about the Log4j incident that happened last year. That was certainly top of mind for every engineering team, so much so that, like, I had, you know, my in-laws, who are extremely not technical, asking me about Log4j and how it impacted us. But I'm sure a lot of developers were asked by their family about that incident. But just as an example, that's something that we really want to make sure is as easy as possible to address as quickly as possible so we can keep our customers secure and keep our developers from having to wake up in the middle of the night to respond to a security vulnerability. And so standardization is really, really important part of how we design engineering systems. And so that's something that we've been working on internally to make sure that we can really kind of reduce what we call the developer toil, how much developers have to respond to ops. Generally, what I'm aiming for is more dev, less ops. So then that kind of brings me to our third-party products, the products that our external customers use. And I'm just super excited about the chapter that we're in terms of our product development. I've been, you know, working up to this for years, and I'm now finally able to actually see the products hit the streets and, you know, see our customers benefit from it. But, you know, there's three things that are really happening together that I think are creating an incredible period for platform engineering. The first is obviously DevOps and the extension of that with DevSecOps. And so we talked about how we have GitHub Advanced Security, and that's coming not just to GitHub, but also for Azure DevOps customers. We talked about that at Ignite. That really allows us to have secret scanning, credential scanning, you know, package vulnerability, kind of detection and remediation, dependency analysis, as well as code scanning, looking for insecure code patterns. And so we can now do that in the context of all of our DevOps solutions and give that feedback both synchronously in a shift left kind of way for the developer as they write the code, but also asynchronously through, you know, PR analysis or code analysis, and then kind of raise issues or even suggest PR fixes for developers. But when you think about that being combined with the virtualization of dev boxes, whether that's through GitHub's CodeSpaces or Microsoft dev box, we now have both the DevOps environment and we have the dev box that can be completely standardized across an engineering organization. And then that brings me to the last point, which is when you build an application, a modern cloud native application today, it's not just the code that you wrote. You have dependencies on cloud services that you also have to instantiate. And oftentimes you need to create a dev test prod stamp that you're going to move through using DevOps and really GitOps to make sure that that is all flowing, that all of your fixes are flowing, and that you're testing the right versions and that you're flowing the right versions out to your customers. And so with Azure deployment environments, which we also talked about at this fall's Ignite, that's another thing that's making it really easy for us to instantiate the entire dev infrastructure, not just the DevOps repo hosting and CI systems, not just the security system that's associated with that, not just the individual developer boxes, but really the dev test prod stamps of the applications that you're working on. Now all of those things are actually coming together so that everyone can have a secure, compliant, easy to instantiate dev infrastructure that really previously was only kind of supplied to by the tech elite because they had the capacity to build it for themselves.
That's great, Amanda. And I love the quote, more dev, less ops. I mean, it's very much about the spirit of keeping developers focused on high value work and removing away the manual tasks. So I love that kind of that thinking and the innovation that's coming through from you and your team. So let me switch now to industry trends. And so as you think about forward looking and what's coming next for you and the team and the innovation that you're driving, what industry trends are you currently following that will impact future work? And of course, today, probably the biggest thing that we're hearing about is things like ChatGPT. But what else and how are you thinking about those trends playing into the direction of your organization and what you're delivering to the industry?
I mean, I think there's several. The first is obviously that over the past few years, developer watering holes have become increasingly the target of malicious hackers. And so we now need to be thinking about dev infrastructure at every level in the context of a malicious, security environment. And so the first thing that I think about is how can we secure the dev infrastructure of the individual developer, of the engineering systems that they're working on? And obviously, I think about that both for, our customers as well as for Microsoft internal engineers.
And so security, if I may, that sounds sort of like zero trust from the developer's fingertips all the way through.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I even want to be able to get to the point, today what we have are really like firewalls in some sense, not firewalls in the networking sense, although there is an aspect of that. But like, we have kind of like barriers that prevent, for example, an individual checking code directly into a production system, right? It has to be, we have policy that we apply. It has to be reviewed by at least two people. And, we have all different compliance kind of checks that we have to do before it's deployed. But that also kind of assumes zero trust in terms of the person who wrote the code. I would love to be able to get to the point where I have provenance for any code edit that made it into our code repo, right? That not only can I identify, what was the account information of the person who made the check-in to the Git repo, but also can I actually track it to their machine? Can I actually see what developer environment they used to make that? And was that even secured in terms of, being able to understand that this is the actual human that I was expecting to make the code edit is actually the person who made the code edit? And then similarly, how do we secure the entire ecosystem? So, for example, we've been working in NuGet for the last couple of years to make sure that that's kind of the most secure package manager and ecosystem that's out there. And we do that through making sure that we have signed packages and things like that. So I think security is definitely the first thing that I think about. The next thing that I think about is really kind of, what can the cloud do to actually supercharge every individual developer and their team? And we talked about that a little bit earlier, so I won't repeat that. I think the next dimension that I really think about is AI and how that can supercharge development teams. And we talked about that as well, but it really will change the way that we build all different kinds of applications, right? It might be that we can take, you know, there's been a huge trend over the last couple of years in terms of empowering low-code developers or people who don't necessarily have a computer science degree or don't have the job title software developer to be able to create especially employee-facing applications. So I think we can use AI to actually empower more of those people to create, especially those employee-facing workflow, business process types of applications. But with that, again, how do we do that in a way that's trustworthy, that's secure? And so, you know, how can we use things like Azure API Monitor, API Management to make sure that that's governed and secure and compliant and that we have complete control over it from the professional context, professional developer context, to make sure that we feel good about empowering these folks who don't necessarily have as much training in writing code. But then also, like, as far as AI, it'll change the way that we even think about what are the skill sets that people need to be successful in writing an application, right? I actually did a talk for our interns, I think it's like 5 years ago now, which is kind of stunning just to think about how long I've been thinking about this particular problem. But, you know, my main point to them was that a lot of what they're taught today in their computer science classes is really just algorithmic thinking, right? They're thinking about how do I write the code? There's a lot of syntax checking and even grammar checking. You know, those kinds of things I think can be brought into the tool so that you don't really think about it quite as much. You know, of course, everybody needs to understand basic math. But, you know, for a certain category of math, it's definitely easier to use a calculator. And so similarly, I think for the act of writing code, you know, there are going to be some instances where AI basically becomes kind of the calculator for complex math. Nobody's using slide rules anymore because we have a calculator. And so even further, it might be that certain categories of applications are, you know, no longer written as applications, they're actually generated based on the use case of what's required for, you know, in the context of the business process, for example, that you need to complete. And so what I think that also means is that the professional developer, which, you know, there's still incredible demand for professional developers throughout the world, but I think the professional developer is going to have to focus more on these, how do we build complex systems? How do we build distributed systems? How can I look at an application that's deployed into production and maybe even, you know, stamped throughout the world in many, many different locations? And how can I actually diagnose an issue that is creating out of memory or, you know, is creating some kind of parallel processing bug or detect a security vulnerability? So it's much more about this systems thinking that we need to get everybody into thinking about. So obviously the first steps that we're making are just, you know, in the context of the code editor or in the context of the PR system and hosted source code control. How can we use these AI systems? For example, GitHub Copilot is based on the large language model, which is based on the model that has been developed by OpenAI. How can we use that AI system to actually inform and augment the individual developer and their team so that they can focus on the code that only they can write? But further, I think we're going to actually really dramatically end up changing the way that people approach writing applications, writing code.
You know, I have to jump in there for a moment. I was stunned by using some of these tools recently to use very natural language to ask the AI, hey, would you generate for me an aggregate using a domain-driven development sort of theory and give me an example of that and explain it? And it just did perfectly. Gave me a great code example that I was actually able to cut and paste and work from and move it from there. But yeah, one of the things that I wonder about AI is many people are saying that, you know, it's going to be a great tool, but I still have to understand what I'm pulling out of it and what it's putting into my code so that I've got still those fundamental coding skills that enable me to select the right solution for the point in time.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of things with that. One of the things that I really think about is the fact that writing software is a team sport, and that, you know, especially for junior developers, of which there are lots of junior developers, lots of people have entered the industry in the last few years and have been hired by, you know, their team more recently. I often feel a lot of empathy for them, because I feel like it's challenging to kind of, you know, join a team that has a lot of experience and seniority and context on the code that they're writing to date, and you're expected to all of a sudden be able to contribute. And the fact that you need to reach out to a more senior developer to be able to get that guidance, sometimes it can feel like you're burdening them. And sometimes even the senior developer can feel like they have a lot on their plate. And, you know, mentoring somebody new can also be yet another thing that they have to respond to. I think in some ways, if the AI can help you understand the code base, if they can help you understand kind of how can I conform to the coding conventions, what's the best algorithm, how could this be improved, if they can do that first line of code review as a pair programmer, then I think we're going to be empowering a lot more junior developers to enter the team, enter the workforce. And, you know, that's kind of what I live for. Like I told you at the top of the hour, like, you know, I started working on this because I wanted to support more people majoring in computer science and entering the industry. And that's what I'm passionate about. And so, you know, if this can help those developers join a team and be successful, I think that's fantastic. I think one of the things that's super cool about the generative AI is how it helps with your creative process. You know, I'm one of those people who I can sometimes get writer's block. I can get coder's block, where you sit at a cursor blinking at you, and you're not necessarily sure of what's the next thing that you need to go do. And I think that one of the things that's incredible about the generative AI application of this is that it can actually help you figure out, okay, what's a good first step to take in terms of solving this problem, this particular problem? How might I approach it? And even once you've written it, it can actually give you some feedback on how it might be further improved. And so I think that's also another dimension of how it's going to help developers kind of get to where they want to go much more quickly, by really just helping them with that creative energy and getting over coder's block.
I love this discussion. And so we, you know, Amanda, you've talked about, and thank you for sharing how you're thinking about the future and embracing things like AI, and what a great dialogue here. So as we come to a close, you know, and as we think about being inclusive of all developers, as we've talked about, irrespective of environment, irrespective of platform, et cetera, you know, in many cases, technical leaders from the team level to the executive level are responsible for providing tools to their development teams. And of course, there are a lot of developer tools and environments out there, including some that compete in the .NET space. What steps, Amanda, would you recommend for those listening here today evaluating development tools that maybe cover a spectrum of backdrop?
It always comes back to, first of all, is the particular runtime or library or application platform that you're planning to use, is it capable of supporting the final scale of the solution that you want to build for? And, you know, certainly I would say .NET, Java, you know, have that scale and have that kind of like track record to show that they can support cloud native scale, you know, consumer scale consumption and like transactions per second. You might look at something like the Tech Empower metric to understand kind of how each of these runtimes perform. And we've been, you know, dramatically focused on improving the performance of .NET over the last couple of versions, to the point where, you know, we're now doing quite well on the Tech Empower metric, just as an example. But the other thing I think you need to look at is really like, does it support the particular domain that you're trying to build for? And what is the ecosystem support for that domain? So whether you're building a mobile application or a machine learning application or a cloud native application, you know, what libraries might you take a dependency on? And does the programming language or application runtime that you're trying to target support that particular domain? And then lastly, for that ecosystem, what does the sponsorship look like? how healthy is that ecosystem? I think there's all different kinds of amazing programming languages that people are designing and various different package managers and libraries that are coming out all the time. But the thing that I think is a challenge in terms of bringing up any new developer ecosystem is, how do you get past the point where it's not just an upstart, but it's actually something that is broadly supported by the community, so that there's not just one single vendor that's working on it, not just one single vendor that's contributing to it, so that you can, you know, really benefit from the creative energy that the broad developer community is putting into it.
Amanda, this has been an absolutely great conversation, but we're kind of at the end of it. And I just want to say that how much I appreciate you taking the time to join us today. It has been a real pleasure having you on the show. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It was fun.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Azure for Executives podcast. We love hearing from you. And if you have suggestions for topics, questions about issues discussed on the show, or other feedback, contact the show host, David Starr, or Paul Marr, through the social media links included in the show notes for each episode. We look forward to hearing from you.